Welcome. Today is the 1st of April, 2016, and while traveling recently, this is not an April Fool's joke, I managed to catch up with Father Chad Ripperger for another discussion like what we had last year. So, Father Ripperger, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So, Father, you mentioned in our last interview that you got your doctorate in Rome on St. Thomas. And so what I wanted to do was talk about one of the bigger issues in philosophy that's very little understood, especially by laymen. So we just start right off to it. What is metaphysics?
Well, metaphysics is a science in the mind of St. Thomas. He says it's a science of the study of the nature of being. So you're studying being itself. And the reason it's called metaphysics is because it's above the phusis in Greek, which is nature. It's above just the consideration of the individual natures of things. So you're not, it's not a science of, say, biology or something of that sort, but it transcends all of them by the most abstract consideration of being. So it includes things like what is existence, what is essence, what are accidents, which are those things which exist in substances, what's a substance. So it goes into all of those different considerations in order to get the most abstract understanding of reality that we can have. Now, for St. Thomas, metaphysics is broken down into three parts based upon three areas that Aristotle tends to discuss it in his metaphysics. First is ontology, which comes from the Greek word for being. So it's the study of being. So you're actually studying being itself. Then there's also what they call first philosophy, which is the study of first principles that govern all being. So like the principle of identity, that is, a thing is what it is. That gives you, once you understand those first principles, then you can start applying them in your reasoning process. But they need to be understood not just logically as how they affect reason, but also ontologically, that is, how they apply to everything that exists, even to God, in fact. The last one is natural theology, that is, what we can know about God through the natural light of reason. And so those are the three areas of metaphysics. And so that gives you kind of a basic grasp of what the science deals with.
All right. So this originates, obviously, in the Greeks and in the Greek tradition. How is it applied more in the Catholic philosophical tradition? What are some of the currents? You mentioned St. Thomas, but how else is this applied?
Well, part of it is that the Greeks, of course, that originally, just before St. Thomas, in the beginning of the Middle Ages, or even before then, a lot of the Greeks were unknown to the theologians in the West, and so historically, a lot of people tended to be more Platonic via the St. Augustine route, and so the only real Greek that had any kind of interaction or kind of impact in Catholic thinking for a while was Plato, of course, and then you had to be very careful because some of the things he says is contrary to the Catholic faith, etc. But then, of course, via the Muslims, the works of Aristotle start making their way into the Middle Ages into Europe, and they get translated from the Greek into Latin, and then those start to have a big impact throughout the people of the Middle Ages. Of course, there was a bit of a division historically in the Middle Ages because some still stuck to the Augustinian tradition and considered Aristotle heretical or a pagan or what have you, and so they wouldn't do that. But some of them started picking it up, people like Albert the Great, St. Thomas Aquinas, and many after him. And so from there, it just kind of grew. That meant that the philosophical tradition of the Greeks became the slowly over the course of time became the foundation and the terminology for even some Catholic thought, some areas of Catholic theology. And so that's where it ended up having quite a bit of an impact. The bringing of Aristotle into the mainstream of the church and having him have a huge impact really probably is more the credit of St. Thomas than anybody else. But others recognized it even after St. Thomas had recognized the importance of Aristotle's works specifically, and a few other Greeks, too, had made their way into the Catholic intellectual ambit.
Like Cardinal Bessarion.
Yes.
People like that. Okay. What are some particular errors in metaphysics that we deal with today?
Well, there's the particular areas of metaphysics that you see today, we can just break it down. One of them was actually dealt with, if we start with natural theology, some people don't think that you can know God through the natural light of reason. And so that was one of the things that was actually dealt with at Vatican I, primarily because of the modernists, but it basically that you can know God through the natural light of reason. And in fact, St. Thomas, not only can you know that God exists, but you can actually know his attributes in large parts. Obviously, you can't know the things of the Trinity, but that's because, as St. Thomas says, that whenever God acts ad extra, that is outside of himself, he always acts as a unified cause in relationship to the three persons of the Trinity. So you can never fully divine that from the natural reality. This is one of the reasons we need revelation. But you can know quite a bit about God through the natural light of reason. So today, a lot of it is based people's denial of the knowledge of God, and that you can come to knowledge of God is ultimately rooted in certain metaphysical problems in relationship to reality. It's a common teaching among philosophers that what your cosmology is, how you view the physical world or the world around you, will determine what your understanding of God actually is. And so what's happening is slowly but surely is, due to modern philosophers and a few other things, people's understanding of the real world has degraded their ability to actually understand understand things about God through the natural light of reason. Some of that also goes back to first philosophy. So in first philosophy, you have philosophers that would deny things like the principle of non-contradiction in the end was actually denied by Hegel, who said things are constantly changing. You go from a thesis to an antithesis, then to a synthesis, and the synthesis is the combination of the two contradictory positions of the thesis and the antithesis. So the denial of the principle of non-contradiction and things of that sort is one of the causes for people not understanding reality properly, and so they don't end up understanding God. Then, of course, you also ended up with a huge problem with the epistemology. It does predate Descartes to some degree, especially with the nominalists. But with Descartes, you ended up with this situation where he ends up being skeptical about what his senses tell him. Later, he uses God, that God wouldn't, God would not deceive us through our senses all the time. And so later, when philosophers start taking a good look at that, they say, well, wait a minute, once you cut yourself off from reality, from your senses, there's no getting back. And this is what ends up happening with Kant. So Kant ends up dividing, he says, between what's called the phenomena and the noumena. Well, there's the thing in itself, the noumena. We, in the end, don't really know what that is, because we don't know if there's a problem with our senses. We don't know if the senses are giving us an accurate accounting of this. And then as a result of that, you can't know God through looking at created reality. So as a result of that, metaphysics collapsed, at least in relationship to natural theology, although Kant tries to sneak God in other ways. But you have that problem. Plus, then you also ended up with the problem of Hume with the theory of constant conjunction, that a thing doesn't, that the existence of a thing, that in the principle of motion or the principle of causation, that the cause causes the effect. He ended up denying that and just saying that we just see one thing moving with another. Well, in the end, that means that causation is lost, and so the thing external to me doesn't cause things in my senses, and so as a result of that, or there's just this constant conjunction, which means I don't really know the thing as such. So it's that constant conjunction and then the collapse of epistemology as a result of that with Descartes' skepticism. That results in Kant, who, as a result of that, ends up basically going even back to Descartes' argument for God's existence, proof for existence, which is basically the ontological argument, and says, it doesn't work. You can't use that. So the point being in all of this is that the collapse in metaphysics was really partly the cause of epistemology, but partly because people started denying first principles, causation, non-contradiction, and things of this sort, so that by the time you get to this age, where we're at now, those principles don't seem to have any bearing on people's even, quote, scientific investigation, unquote.
Interesting. Now, you mentioned Kant. In the Critique of Pure Reason, Kant makes space and time his constants. So we don't know things as they really are, but space and time are the constant. What does that mean, and how does that impact certain modern people like Einstein?
Well, one of the things is that for Kant, because we don't know the noumena, the thing in itself, that is, the thing in reality, all we know is the phenomena, which is our experience of a thing. So Kant, in analyzing that epistemologically, began to realize that it was the, if you accept that principle, it appears that it's the mind that imposes categories on your experience. In other words, he says that the accidents of Aristotle, like quantity, quality, time, etc., those place, those things are, in fact, something that the mind imposes on the on your experience, not upon the reality itself. We don't know if it applies to reality itself. We just know it's something that applies, is imposed on that. Einstein had read Kant and used that, we know this from letters that he had written to Bohr, that meant that you could actually, because these are categories imposed on the mind, on the phenomena, that is your experience, that means that you can actually, that time and space and things like that become relative to the individual rather than something absolute on the outside. This, of course, becomes most people don't know this, the foundational philosophical principles, which, as many people know, higher levels of mathematics are actually based on philosophical presuppositions. So the mathematician will start with a set of presuppositions philosophically about what he thinks nature or reality is, and from there he derives the mathematics. Well, Einstein was no different, and in this particular case, that's where the theory of general relativity and things like that came out. So the difficulty with that is, though, of course, is that these things are not subjective to us. There is an actual absolute motion or an absolute location in relationship to the totality of the universe, which is finite. But that all being said, it has largely to do with the Kantian philosophical and even metaphysical understanding of these things that resulted in Einstein's theories, some of them which did reveal certain things, true, other things that ended up being false, even like certain constants that he said these things are constants, we found out that they're not later.
So now, you mentioned, of course, too, about cosmology and causation. Those are two, you know, very important issues for a lot of discussions today, and the biggest one being evolution. Now, you've written a book called The Metaphysics of Evolution. Tell us real quick how metaphysics comes into play with evolution and how evolution, as you argue in the book, violates those particular principles of metaphysics.
Well, there's essentially two primary areas where I discuss it. The first is in first philosophy, that is the discussion of first principles. So one of the first principles is the principle of sufficient reason. Now, the formal formulation of that principle is the existence of a thing is accountable either in itself or in another. So with that, in colloquially, we would just say, you can't give what you don't have. So the existence of a thing, either the thing has it itself, or it's being caused by some other thing. And without one of those two, then as a result of that, you can't have the effect, because it has to be accountable somewhere. Well, the principle of sufficient reason is systematically and denied in evolution, because they basically say that something that doesn't have sight, that is the existence of sight, can somehow beget sight. And they say, well, it's due to mutations and things like that. But the fact of the matter is that mutations would simply beget something else that's like the thing that's causing the mutation. So if the thing doesn't have sight, it's not going to end up causing sight through some kind of affecting of the DNA process or passing on the DNA through mutations. So again, it's one of those things where the first principle is being denied. There's a number of first principles that it ends up denying, but one of them, one of the other sides of it is too, as I deal with, is in ontology itself. St. Thomas observes in his writings, based upon the whole Aristotelian tradition, and in fact, after St. Thomas, it was something that was adopted by all sound philosophers, is that essences do not change. As a result of that, because the essence doesn't change, then and the nature of an essence is such that if you look at created things, they are incapable of directly causing an essence. What do we mean by that? The nature of a thing or a substance. And why do we say that? We say that because everything we do or anything that's created always acts upon the absence of a thing, like its place or the time in which it's in, or the qualities that are in it. It doesn't actually directly cause the substance of the thing. And so St. Thomas shows clearly that only God can be the cause of the substance or the essence of a thing. What's happened is with evolution, is they deny that understanding by saying that these lower things can actually cause the essence of something that's higher. That's not only just a violation of the principle of sufficient reason, but it's a denial of it's the principle of sufficient reason in the sense if you don't have this existence, you can't cause it. But it's also a denial of the principle of sufficient reason in this sense. Accidents always exist in a substance. As a result of that, on the ontological grades of being, substance is higher than accidents. And that means that accidents can't cause something higher than them, so they can't cause a substance. Even if a variety of different created things act upon a thing, they can't directly cause that higher substance. So in this book that I wrote, I basically talk about how if you apply authentic metaphysics to mystic metaphysics to evolution, you begin to realize as a theory, it cannot hold up scientifically, not just in the empirical sense, but even in the philosophical sense.
Now that's fascinating, because then a lot of evolutionists and their people support that. And then they'd say, well, wait a minute, though. We don't really observe these kind of... Say, they might take Berkeley's argument. I've actually seen that in some places. Well, we don't really observe substance, right? We just observe, you know, the qualities in matter. Right, and so matter isn't entirely. It seems like they understand matter without understanding any concept, because it's almost entirely materialist.
Right, that's part of it. That's a large part of it. Part of it is because our senses only tell us things about the accidents of a thing, whereas when we talk about the nature, the substance of a thing, we're talking about an intellectual grasp of a thing, which is something that's immaterial. It's not material. And so Berkeley, being a materialist, wouldn't go beyond that. He would just say, well, we just see the accidents of certain things. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, doesn't Berkeley end up denying substance in a certain sense? Not just knowledge, but just there isn't. It's just all these accidents. Right. So, but the difficulty with that is, though, is that we know that accidents can't exist on their own. So, for example, the quality of color, you don't see just blue walking down the street. It's always some blue thing, some blue substance that... exists. And accidents, because they don't exist on their own, their existence has to be communicated, that's the technical term for it, has to be communicated or caused by something that can do that, and that's what a substance does.
Now, Father, evolution has many daughters, in as much as there's many different areas in the modern world where it's had a great deal of influence, one of which immediately is communism. In fact, Engels, who was Marx's most devoted disciple and his secretary and friend, Engels had declared at Marx's, eulogized Marx after his death and said, without a Charles Darwin, you could never have a Karl Marx. Likewise, it's influenced various ideas in economics. Of course, Malthus predates Darwin, but Malthus and Darwin are taken together and applied in capitalism, especially by thinkers like Ricardo and others. Then you have... ultimately, Galton and eugenics, right, in these areas, and those have been fairly decently researched and are known to a certain extent. But one place that nobody really looks at is Darwin's evolution's effect in anthropology, especially vis-a-vis men and women. How has evolution affected our understanding of men and women?
Well, that's a good question. I think it takes a little bit of background first. If you remember when I just mentioned Hegel, that Hegel had this dialectic where we go from the thesis to the antithesis to the synthesis. Between him and then the collapse of metaphysics and the collapse of the idea that natures don't change, it meant that natures can change. So human nature can change. And one thing can beget something else. So the whole Darwinian thing, which is also ultimately based upon kind of a principle that things are constantly changing, even the natures or essences of things are changing. As a result, and so you can say ultimately that there's no one true common nature in relationship to anything. What ends up happening is that in relationship to like communism and things like that, human nature doesn't have a set structure. As a result of that, because it doesn't have a set structure or a set nature, there's no natural law which determines how human beings are supposed to behave, how they should be governed, things of this sort. And so as a result, then you can simply change or do anything you want in order to obtain the desired effect without taking into consideration that man has a natural inclination to certain things. So, for example, Leo XIII was very clear that human beings have a natural inclination to owning property, where communism denies that, and because of the fact that they don't have any concept of the natural law. So because there's not a set structure to any of this, it means that, you know, then you can pretty much do anything you want, and human nature is changeable. In the eugenics program, that's part of the thing that you're seeing, is that they want to continue to modify human beings to the point where they reach what they consider the pinnacle or some type of perfect human being on a natural level.
A mega point.
Yeah, exactly. Without any concept of the fact that there's this human nature, and that by doing the eugenics or even genetic modifications, which we're seeing now today too, is that you're actually tampering with something that was given a structure to it, a nature to it, or an essence to it by God, and so there's no concept of that. But this applies not just to human natures, it also ends up applying to things like gender. Gender no longer has a specific structure or a determinate structure, that human beings as such are not designed to be men and women, and that men and women, which is something I'm talking in a book that I'm writing about on the psychology of men and women, hopefully it'll be out, you know, in the future, but basically it talks about how there's even a natural structure to masculinity and to femininity, and as a result of that, it has natural inclinations towards specific things. So men and women, one of the natural inclinations that men and women have is an attraction to the opposite sex. There's a natural inclination to the opposite sex. Well, once evolution enters into that picture and there's no set structure, then it doesn't mean anything as far as to be a man means a specific thing, to be a woman means a specific thing, and that you can take elements of both, or you can decide because I wasn't, that human beings were created a specific way. St. Thomas says, as part of the first category of natural inclination, the natural law, is that we have a natural inclination to preserve our being as it is. Well, if there's no natural law, then I don't have this natural inclination to preserve myself as it is, and so there's no reason why I couldn't have a change in gender, or I couldn't, you know, the natural inclinations towards children, because we know that the generative faculty in man is ordered towards having children as its primary end, which is what the popes and the church have told us for centuries. But that all being said, they don't see it having a different nature, and so things can change, things can become fluid, and in the end, various elements can be introduced. So evolution, being as part of that, and also means that man will eventually evolve to the point where these set things are no longer important or necessary. We may evolve to the point where, you know, gender is just this whole admixture. This is why, you know, you get on the internet and it's, you know, transgenders and homosexuals and lesbians, and then by the time it's done, it's, you know, gender identity issues, and things have just completely gone all over the map, because evolution has dislodged people from an understanding that that the natures of things don't change, and as a result of that, people don't even think human nature is subject to that. They think that human nature itself can change, and so they don't see why we should be bound to those things from the past that every human being understood.
And that's interesting, the way you talk about with gender. Isn't it the case that they would ask you your sex, not your gender? That sex was masculine and feminine. But gender was a grammatical term, largely, dealing with the types of things that are just analogous to male and female in languages that have grammatical gender.
Yeah, I think there's a real reason for that. I mean, this is partly my own speculation, but I think it's sound. And it's not, there's other parts of it that aren't. Some of the philosophers have pointed out that one of the upshots of Descartes is that he did not see the human being as the soul informing the body and making the human body be what it is, so that that the body-soul composite was one substance. So he ended up thinking, kind of like Plato did, that the soul is one thing and then the body is another. So what ends up happening is, and then the second thing is that this rationalism where you abstract from, you're not dealing with concrete things, but you're just dealing with abstractions or universals or concepts. What ends up happening is people's view of themselves starts becoming divorced from their actual body. So a lot of times people say things like, I'm a man in a woman's body. So the soul or the psychology that they've adopted as a result of this abstraction or this rationalism results in a thinking that who I am, my true identity, has nothing to do with my body, when in point in fact it's a combination of the two. So that sex is primarily something in which you're talking about the ontological quality in the human body, whereas gender has become abstracted from that, where it's something that can, it's more of a psychological term almost today, the way that it's talked about. And as a result of that, someone can have gender identity issues, which basically just means that they're psychologically, they think they're this, that, or the other thing, even though it doesn't have any correspondence to the body. And that is a direct cause also of the breakdown in metaphysics, because metaphysics, and part of metaphysics is the discussion of matter and form, that the matter becomes what it is by the form. In other words, the human soul, which is the form of the body, which the church has formally defined, means that it's the soul that makes this body be a human body, not just the DNA, but it's what actually makes this body be human. And so that's why it's one substance, and it's the form of a dog that makes that particular set of matter be a dog. That has all been divorced, especially with this abstractionism or this that is sometimes caused from a Cartesian approach, both psychologically and epistemologically, to these matters.
Now, you've written a whole book on psychology, the Introduction to the Science of Mental Health, which I'll have linked up in the episode notes here. Now, in psychology, they used to treat gender identity disorder as a disorder, as something, and they had ways of treating it, and they would cure people from that. But now you see that, that's forbidden, because that's not respectful to these people's issues or whatever. So now they don't treat it; instead, they encourage it. And you see this thing. I'll link this one too. This woman that thinks she's a cat. And that she's a cat gender. And so the cat, it's just, she dresses like a cat. She's really a cat in a human's body. And which is absurd on a number of levels. But hopefully that shouldn't have to be broken down for the listening audience. But nevertheless, so how much has evolution penetrated psychology to the point where they don't treat these as disorders anymore? Instead, they encourage and assist them.
It really boils down to evolution, because things are constantly changing. All things are fluid. So you can't say that this is the way it ought to be, and so it can be any way whatsoever. That, coupled with the fact that who I am, my true identity, isn't connected in any way to my body, means that it's my interior feelings, or my interior, even though for St. Thomas your feelings are part of your body, it's my interior feelings, it's what I think interiorly that's the true me, and so it's not right that somebody should impose their objective views about what they think reality is on me, because my feelings are different from that. So it's that fluidity from the evolution and the rationalism from Descartes that you end up with this problem.
You've also written a book on the morality of the exterior act, which deals with the question of the integral good. What does that mean, and why is it important?
The principle of the integral good, St. Thomas and the whole moral tradition actually with him, states, it's formulated this way: the good is from an integral cause, evil from any defect whatsoever. And basically what that means is that, like in a moral act, there's three components. The object, that's what you're doing, so for example, throwing a baseball. The second is the intention, why you're doing it. So you may be throwing the baseball in order to strike the pitcher out because you're playing the game. And then the third is the circumstances which surround it. So St. Thomas and the whole moral tradition says that when you look at the principle of the integral good, it means that if any one of those three is evil, if you will the act that all three of those come together in your will, which is what happens in choice, then what happens is that what you choose is evil. The whole act is rendered evil. So this is something that people have, the principle of the integral good has completely collapsed in the last 50 years. You see this all over the map. Everything from movies, where people will watch movies that are gravely offensive to God, but they don't think it's a problem that they're responsible for playing them, because of the fact that they don't see that, well, my intention is X, and therefore it's okay. And so, and this is also part of the abstraction, the Cartesianism, where what you're doing doesn't have any connection to what you're thinking, and so they don't see that there's any real problem with any of that. But this has also affected various areas of the church. It's affected ecclesiology, because in ecclesiology, they'll say one religion, some people now in the church will actually say one religion is almost as good as another, which is, of course, a Freemasonic principle, but they'll say that because of the fact that they reject the completely traditional principle that one false doctrine renders your religion false or evil. And so they reject those things. And so you're seeing that all come along. This is also being now applied even in all areas of morality, where people say, well, as long as my intention is good, then things are fine. And it's the principle of the integral good, which is why we know things like the ends don't justify the means. We know that that's true.
So now, in regards to a more burning issue today, divorce and remarriage, you'll see a couple cases that'll generalize the different types of categories. So the first one will be a guy who dumps his wife and three or four kids and goes off with a younger, hotter, more attractive secretary. And then, you know, everyone acknowledges that's evil. The guy's a scumbag. He's not going to have anyone coming out supporting him and saying, oh, yeah, you're a good guy. But then you have the mixed case where things didn't work, people argue, they just didn't get along, and hey, we're not the people we married, and so then they divorce and then marry people that they seem to be happier with. And there you have mixed results, and it's not so clear these people are scumbags, they're just flawed. Then you get to the third case, falling out maybe from the first, where you got the guy who ditches his wife and three kids for the younger, hotter secretary, or vice versa. And so now this woman is sitting there with three kids and a single mom, which is one of the hardest things, and then remarries just because she needs to take care of the kids, it seems. And it's a strain. And that last one's probably the hardest case, which will garner the most support. Yeah, she's doing the right thing because she's got, you know, that's how people will say it. But based on what you're saying, they're all wrong. So especially with that last case, because the first is clear, and to anyone who's rightly ordered Catholic can see why the second's clear, at least you'd think. But the third one is a really hard case, and you look like a jerk for trying to say she shouldn't get remarried. So what's the principle? Especially in the third case, she wrong?
Well, before I fully answer that question, because I think that's a really good question, I think we have to first back up just a little bit. I want to talk a little bit about the psychology of sin. In the psychology of sin, when we choose something evil, that is, something contrary to the integral good, what has to happen is reason makes an act of conscience and recognizes this thing's evil, and that's presented to the will. St. Thomas says that you can't choose something evil as such. You always have to choose it either because it's really good or because it's under the appearance of the good. So what has to happen is psychologically, we know this from our own personal experience when we commit sin, the evil part, we move our reason to ignore that particular evil aspect of it so that we can focus only on the good, which is a sign, again, that we're inclined to the integral good, because if we weren't inclined to the integral good, we could just will both of them and it wouldn't be an issue. So what does this really mean? How does this connect it to the whole marriage question? Well, it is in this sense. We can't ignore the defects that are in the relationships that people have in the order of justice in order to accommodate people emotionally or on other levels. So when you marry somebody, both from the natural law point of view of marriage, because St. Thomas argues that even natural law marriage is supposed to be for life. Now, that's putting aside the whole ability of the church to dissolve a natural law marriage in favor of a sacramental one. But that basically means that even on a natural law marriage, he says, children and the obligations that people have to each other require that it be a permanent thing. So justice to each other from the beginning requires that it's a permanent institution. Then Christ comes along and adds on top of the natural law marriage, he adds the sacrament, and he says, What God has joined, that is on the sacramental level, no man can lay asunder. Not even the Pope can dissolve a sacramental marriage in which consummation has occurred. That being the case, it means that we can't just let people divorce, which brings up an interesting historical point, which I'll bring up here in a minute. We can't just let people divorce and remarry, because when they remarry, the remarrying is done contrary to justice, and so the principle of the integral good is being violated there. That means that marriage, as a moral act, that is entering into marriage and giving vows, etc., has to observe the principle of the integral good. So, but what's interesting is, historically in the past, the church used to tell people, you could not civilly divorce your husband or your wife until the church itself had said that the marriage was null and void. Why? Because of the fact that the divorce was a public repudiation of the marriage, that the marriage no longer was binding, even on the, at least in relationship to the civil effects. Whereas the church's attitude is, no, as long as they're sacramental, there's still some obligations in relationship to the civil effects, even if they're suspended for a time because of abuse or some grave cause. That being the case, what's happened is after Vatican II, they inverted the process where now if you try and get an annulment, you have to get the divorce first, so you have to publicly repudiate the marriage first in the eyes of other people before you can actually get the annulment. But that basically, what that means is though, even with these other people, justice has to still be served. So even with the woman who's in the hard case, whose husband was abusive, or she needed to get away from him because she had a grave cause, because he was being physically abusive to the children, and so she needed to live separately from him, justice still has to be served, and so she can't enter into another marriage without that integral cause being observed. And so what's happening is, and to go back to this whole psychology of sin, people tend today, not just with their own sin, but even with other people's sin, ignore the evil that's present in order to just focus on what appears to be good.
And that seems to be what's going on more frequently as divorce and remarriage has been lifted to a major issue under the current pontificate. And it is a major issue in the West. I mean, I think more than 50% of marriages end in divorce in the United States and Europe. So there's been a lot of discussion about them. How do we include all these people who are divorced and remarried in the church? As if trading in one spouse like a used car looking for a better deal were okay, right? So what principles would be violated if this was normalized in the church, or even if they stopped short, as some reports are saying? Because, we can't, admit these people to Holy Communion, but we should be including them in lectors and extraordinary ministers, and they should be at parish meetings. I mean, technically, if you're divorced or remarried, you can go in the church whenever you want. You just can't receive the Holy Communion.
Right.
Because you're like anyone else who's in a state of mortal sin. So what are some of the principles that are being violated if they start in this put actively normalize the lives of these people in the mind of the faithful?
Well, obviously, St. Paul says in order to receive the Eucharist, which we see with all the other sacraments of the living, that you basically have to be in the state of grace in order to receive them. So these people who are divorced and remarried are, at least on an external level, considered to not be leading a state of grace. Now, if they are... violating the sixth commandment in that process, de facto they actually are. But there's actually two parts to marriage, and this is something that most people don't realize. In the past, they used to call it bed and board. Bed meant that you had a right to the conjugal act once you were legally married. And before then, you didn't have a right to it. The second was board, which basically meant that a wife had a right for the husband to support her so she could stay home to take care of the children. And it also included, the fact that he had the obligation that his affections would, in relationship to romantic things and things of that sort, would rest only in her. And he had a right that his wife would stay home to take care of things in order for this all to happen. When people live together that aren't legally married, this applies whether it's just fornication involved or adultery because of divorce and remarriage, they're taking on something that they don't have a right to. They don't have a right to live together because of the fact that they're not married, which grants them that right. Okay. That all being said, what happens is that there's two areas to consider. One, they can't receive communion because of the fact that they're in a situation where even if they're not violating the sixth commandment, the cohabitation itself can only be justified for a grave cause, according to the moralists. The moralists would say, suppose they ended up having children, they could live together for the sake of the children, but they had to live a brother and sister. So this meant that it was only because of grave cause that they could be place themselves in an occasion of grave sin. Normal men and normal women, when you're living and very often sleeping in the same bed together, it's going to be very difficult to avoid the conjugal act just because of the nature of human frailty given original sin. But that also means that they're in a state where, even if they're not committing sin, they're in a state where there is grave occasion for sin, which itself is mortally sinful unless there's grave cause. And even then, there has to be that grave cause. So then, of course, there's also the injustice. If they're divorced and remarried, they're committing the injustice of adultery against their prior spouse. A lot of people say, well, my marriage wasn't valid. Well, the Catholic Church, especially because of the whole Protestant situation during the time in which Trent finally dealt with it, just basically says, look, all sacraments are putatively valid until positive proof to the contrary. Your prior marriage is considered valid in the eyes of the Church until they prove positively that it's not there. Then you're free to marry the person, okay, which we call an annulment. The point being is that what people feel doesn't change the objective metaphysical reality of whether the sacrament is present or not. That all being said, it means that when it comes to the life of the Church, it means that they have to take the position that any other person who, what the saints used to call the peccatores, as the people living in the state of mortal sin, had to take. They were still had the obligation to go to Mass, and they could still go into church, they could still pray in God to ask them to help them to get out of the situation or whatever, or to ameliorate their situation, but they couldn't approach the sacraments of the living without that, or they couldn't even go to confession without the purpose of amendment, which means they would have to forego, they would, you know, if there's not grave cause, they would actually have to leave the person they're living with, etc. Now, this also means then, okay, so what about them being lectors and Eucharistic ministers and things of that sort? Well, putting aside the whole question about whether lay people should be giving out communion at all anyway, and if the Church just went back to priests doing it, we wouldn't have this problem even on that level. But it basically boils down to this. You should never have anybody performing a liturgical function in which there's something compromised in a grave level. Now, obviously, we can't say in a minor or a slight level because then not even priests could serve at Mass. But the point being is that if there's something gravely compromised in the person's life, then they really shouldn't be in the sanctuary or touching holy things or dealing with holy things because of the fact that, just much like the Jews, they're not clean spiritually, and so only that which is purified should touch that which is purified, or purity itself, which is God and the Eucharist. But also, even being a lector, because of the whole point of scandal, people will look at it and say, oh, well, then there's no problem with somebody who's divorced and remarried doing all these things. Or it might even affect people's faith. The people that have a right order of faith might find it scandalous that these things are happening, and it makes it more difficult for them to live. Now, this doesn't mean that charity isn't to be served with these people. You still have to treat them with charity and justice and things of that sort, and try and encourage them, you know, continue going to Mass, continue trying to get your life in order, etc. But that means, because of the whole entire tradition of the Church, you can't let them have access to certain areas or certain things due to scandal or their unsuitability to the function.
It seems interesting, almost, I spoke earlier of Hegelian dialectic. Does it seem like we're witnessing, you know, the Church's traditional praxis in these matters, the thesis, this new talk of we've got to include them in the Church in these ways of lector and having running Bible study and teaching catechism, these sort of things, when they're in an objectively public state of adultery, is the antithesis. And then the new synthesis is the Casper proposal.
Yes, I think that's a large part of it. Part of this, of course, is because the whole Hegelian dialectic is an integral part of the modernist mindset that things are changing. Even doctrine is changing. So they would say that even the doctrine that we might see in St. Paul or what the church might have held originally, there's no reason why it can't change. And so there's no reason why, in the end, we can't end up coming up with some type of a compromise, this synthesis of somewhere in relationship to this. And then, of course, once you get to that compromise becomes the new, or the new synthesis becomes the thesis in the ongoing process. So it becomes the thesis to the antithesis and then to the thesis, so that as time goes on, the doctrine is constantly changing. So there's no reason, because doctrine is constantly changing, and because they have no concept of an objective metaphysics and all those things which we talked about earlier, they see no reason why the church just shouldn't change to accommodate where people are at.
With a lot of the discussions at the last two synods, and where, of course, the Casper proposal is going and things of this sort, should it come down that the Holy Father, whether however it comes about, that they say that you should be giving, that the divorced and remarried may go and receive communion. Does this compromise the church's moral authority in her infallibility in docendo in regard to morals?
Not objectively or in itself. That is, because of the fact that God gave the authority, Christ gave the authority to the apostles and said, he who hears you, hears me, go and teach all nations, etc. Also St. Peter's, which we see where he says to St. Peter, whatever you bind on earth shall be bound in heaven. Here we're talking about the church's teaching in relationship to what is infallible. Council of the First Vatican Council laid out the conditions for that infallibility. So if it comes from a synod, the synod itself doesn't meet the conditions necessary for infallibility. So it doesn't affect the intrinsic or the objective authority of the church. Now, it will have the psychological effect of impacting people's ability to either accept infallibility or accept the church as a moral teacher. I've seen this even in my own life, talking to Protestants who are kind of wondering what's kind of going on over there in the Vatican, because they know that you can't have divorce and remarriage, even though most of them do it. You can't have divorce and remarriage, etc., and they shouldn't be participating in life of the church, etc. So that being the case, it wouldn't objectively change its moral authority, but it would change people's psychological perspective on it. And I think it would also be an occasion of scandal, because many people who don't understand the principles of infallibility or how other teachings of the Pope, what degrees of authority they have and how we're bound to them and to what degree we're bound to them, who don't understand those things, could easily be led astray.
Father Ripperger, thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much for having me.